Blog Talk Radio.
Into another exciting show of the Gist of Freedom Radio. Today is July the 3rd. Today's Black History Fact of the Day is Prince Hall formed the first Masonic Lodge for African and African-American men in the city of Boston, Massachusetts, on this day in the year 1776. We have an exciting show lined up for you. We will be speaking... We'll be speaking shortly with Professor Ortiz here on the Gist of Freedom Radio Show. Mr. Ortiz hosts an annual African-American history tour and lecture. We'll be speaking with him about that, in addition to his latest book, Emancipation Betrayed. Professor Ortiz, are you on the line with us?
Yes, sir, I'm on the line. Thank you.
Fantastic, fantastic. I'd like to start the show off with one very simple question. That question being, who is Mr. Ortiz?
Well, thank you, Jamal, for the question. First of all, it's an honor to be in your program. I'm really excited. I direct the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program, and I'm a professor in the Department of History at the University of Florida. And I do a lot of research and teaching on African-American history, Latino history and politics and other topics.
Fantastic. Tell us a little bit more about this history tour that you have coming up here in the next week, not this week, but the week after.
Well, we're really excited. I'm actually just one of many speakers. Sherry Dupree, who is a historian in Florida, a noted historian, I should add, and also a faculty member at Santa Fe College, is really organizing this. This is sponsored by UNESCO, and this is a wonderful opportunity for teachers and others who are interested in learning more about African-American history. It's really a whole week of activities from starting next week to the end of Friday, and I'm actually giving a talk on kind of Reconstruction period through Jim Crow, you know, with a focus in the South and especially on Florida. And again, this is an effort to really also build curriculum for, you know, teachers and members of the community who want to learn more about African-American history during the periods of Reconstruction, so-called Redemption, Jim Crow, and really going into the Civil Rights Movement era. What we hear often here in Florida is that teachers are really struggling to come up with materials to teach their classes, you know, whether it's high school, middle school, or K through six. And so the idea behind the tour is to help give them those materials as they're going to sites, learning firsthand about the history, also giving folks resources that they can take directly into their classrooms for young people.
That's awesome. So, again, this is primarily for teachers and educators as opposed to the general public?
Well, no, it really, you know, anyone who wants to contact Sherry can certainly contact her. I just mentioned those are some of the major constituencies that we tend to get are people who are, you know, both classroom teachers, but also people, Jamal, who teach in the community. I mean, for example, just a couple of weeks ago, the oral history program at the University of Florida worked with a community group here in Gainesville on Juneteenth. Juneteenth, as many of your listeners know, is a day of celebration that African Americans organized in celebration of the fact that they had to spread the word about emancipation by word of mouth in Texas, because the slaveholders were keeping that the word of emancipation from them because they wanted to extend slavery. And so the people that organized the Juneteenth event here in Gainesville, I know you find this is true in a lot of communities, are not formal teachers in the sense they're not necessarily professional, you know, K through 12 or professors or instructors. They're just people that work out in the community as community educators.
I understand. One such teacher here in the Los Angeles area, he said he graduated from the University of USC. So he said calls it the University of South Central, you know, where he, you know, is, as you're alluding to, a community teacher, you know, where the people are, that's where he's at. Delivering information to them. So I understand exactly what you're talking about. Now, is it the first annual event, or has it been going on for some time?
It's been going on for some time, and Sherry Dupree, we should add, is really a very important teacher of history in Florida and in the United States generally. I mean, just one idea of what she does, she takes people on tours of the Rosewood Florida site. You're familiar with Rosewood.
I'm familiar, but let's take a quick second and elaborate on what Rosewood was or is for the folks in that listening audience who may not know.
Okay. Rosewood, Florida was a town in the state of Florida, and it was a very, you know, it was a small town, but it was a very successful town where African Americans had built a very strong community. They had a Mason Hall. They had churches. They had small businesses. It was really a thriving, small town, like many small towns in the United States. What happened in 1923 was that there were allegations, later on proven to be completely false, that an African-American had raped a white woman. And then subsequently to that, white folks in the entire region came to Rosewood and began killing people, burned down all the houses, burned down all the churches, drove people out. It was a complete massacre or a racial pogrom. And after that silence, people were terrorized. They were afraid to speak until 1994. A group of survivors got together, filed suit against the state of Florida for compensation, and actually won that case because they argued that the state of Florida should have protected life and property, did not do so. Mm-hmm. Now, what Sherry does is she takes people to Rosewood, the actual town, where the town used to be, and she takes you on a tour. She does this with people from all over the world have come for this tour. Sherry Dupree takes them and essentially walks you through where the town used to be, who the people were, what their dreams and hopes were, what happened to them. But equally important, the story afterwards, the aspirations, you know, the continued struggles that African Americans in Florida continue to wage, even in the wake of this terrible cataclysm in 1923.
Mm-hmm. Now, I hear you talking about it in past tense. Am I correct in thinking that Rosewood no longer exists? Is it just a bunch of trees and dirt roads, or what's the state of Rosewood today?
Rosewood, the African American town, was completely wiped out. And there were other cataclysms like this actually in the state of Florida, but throughout the country. There is now an effort, and really this is in large part thanks to people like Sherry Dupree, have been able to get a historical marker. There's actually a marker on the road to Rosewood. It's been torn down a couple times, but it's been put back up. And there has been talk about trying to build some kind of permanent museum at some point for this. I actually just supervised the first dissertation, or I helped to supervise. I was on a dissertation committee of a student who just completed what will be the first dissertation on the history of the Rosewood town and massacre at the University of Florida. So, yeah, it's a past event in one way, but at the same time, this tour and events like it are trying to bring that history to life and trying to use it as an example of, you know, where are we now
right.
in terms of African history, you know, and where do we need to go?
Certainly, certainly. Like all history, I like to say, you know, it's past, but it certainly affects our present and, you know, guides us for the future. So I really would like to commend you all on what it is you're doing. It sounds like you're, again, bringing it to life, making it a present event, and hopefully folks will take it into the future and, like I said, make that memorial and remember the names and faces and businesses and you know, project those on into the future. I'm proud of our history. For the past about 14 years or so, I've literally dedicated my life to studying our history. We know that, you know, the history of a people is not just theirs. You know, it's a world history, collective history. What I mean is that, you know, we've recently seen the uprising in Egypt where people are singing songs from the civil rights era even. You know, we shall overcome and, you know, standing by the river and all these sorts of things. And I think that's beautiful. Beautiful thing. I understand that you recently received a Chavez Award. If you could tell us what motivated you to begin studying African American history.
Well, it really came out of my own life history, because I grew up in a Latino, or some folks call it Hispanic, community in Washington State, and I grew up hearing my father tell stories about Jim Crow, and mm-hmm. he talked about three-way Jim Crow in Houston, Texas, because that's where he grew up, and I was always fascinated by these stories of segregation. And the older I got, I went to the United States Army. I was in the Army for 4 years. And beginning to talk to people, it was clear to me that the African-American history experience, the African-American experience in particular, was crucial to understanding both the best aspects of American history, but also the things that went wrong, i.e., say, the defeat of Reconstruction mm-hmm. in 1866. And I began to learn from reading people like W.E.B. Du Bois that the defeat of Reconstruction was really the most cataclysmic event of American history. And it really set the country back. And so I began to study these, like, key periods. And, you know, if you talk, becoming a community organizer, it became clear to me that I had to learn from people like A. Philip Randolph, Mary McLeod Bethune,
mm-hmm.
You know, Ella Baker. Because both as a community organizer trying to change the world, that's where the best lessons were from. And when I was working with the United Farm Workers in the 1980s, for example, we were organizing farm workers, but our playbook was heavily involved in reading people like Ella Baker about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee
mm-hmm.
in Mississippi, about the Congress of Racial Equality. And so you could say that our social change playbook in the United Farm Workers came directly from the African-American freedom struggle. And so, you know, for these reasons and more, I was really directed to learning the centrality of African-American history.
That is awesome. That's awesome. One other list, I'm sure, I'm assuming you drew from is none other than Fannie Lou Hamer as well there in the South and the efforts that she made.
Oh, exactly. You know, in fact, I was just down in Mississippi just no more than a month ago, and I was invited down. We took part in the Freedom Ride reunion. There was a beautiful marker and park dedicated to Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer.
Really?
Yeah, it's actually in, I'm going to blank the name of this now because I went through so many towns. It's near Indianola. It's actually near Glendora, but it's in between Indianola.
Indianola definitely was where she lived. Indianola is definitely where she lived for some time. So yeah, I imagine the gravesite's near.
Yeah, and a group called the Sunflower County Civil Rights Organization. I mean, talking about history. I mean, what people are doing in the Mississippi Delta is equally remarkable. I mean, they are putting up markers, they're building museums, they're bringing in kids to learn about the history of the movement. There's a lot of resistance to what they're doing there, because, you know, there are people in the mainstream, we'll just say historical establishment, that would prefer to keep the history of the South
shiny
in the plantation.
Right.
Yes.
And make it
the
look
big
good.
The big era.
Right.
Gone with the wind.
Exactly.
But here you have, grassroots people, many of them activists in the freedom movement in the 50s and the 60s. Now they're grandparents or great-grandparents, and now they're saying, hey, our kids need to learn this history.
These stories
not being taught.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to do it.
Right. From what I understand, Medgar Evers' home has been preserved and now is a bit of a historical site where people come and take tours. I actually seen a video. Someone shot a video of them on the tour where they looked at Medgar Evers' house, and the people who have sort of memorialized it have, you know, for the best part, best they could, kept in the actual furniture from the time era. From what I understand, there's a toaster there that has a dent in it from when a would-be assassin's bullet came through the window and, you know, dented the toaster that was his toaster at the time. And so, yeah, it's just real beautiful that people are doing that, you know, manifesting some self-determination, saying we don't need to wait for some big agency or firm or anyone to say it's okay for us to, you know, enjoy and embrace our history, but going ahead and doing it themselves. I wanted to speak with you real briefly.
Yeah.
Did you want to elaborate on that point?
Could you say again?
Oh, I was just curious. It sounded as if you wanted to elaborate on that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point you're making. It's that we cannot wait for, I guess you could say, the mainstream of the history establishment to, you know, to tell our own stories. Because, I mean, the story that you just told about Medgar Evers is that house and the Fannie Lou Hamer site, and now there's an initiative to actually build a museum dedicated to Emmett Till.
Emmett Till,
I was in this museum. It's a remarkable place. Everyone should go there. It's an abandoned cotton mill, abandoned cotton gin near the place where Emmett Till's body was actually discovered. And again, the effort to build this museum in his honor is a grassroots effort.
Hmm.
I mean, you have people, again, many of the people who are active in the movement, they didn't just go away. You know,
right.
You read the history book, you get this impression sometimes like, okay, 1965 happened, that was it. You know? But many of them are still there, and they're fighting on the ground. And this time, in addition to all the other struggles that continue to go on with, you know, inequities in education, poor labor conditions, things like that, there's this other dimension that you're trying to get us to think about, which is the historical dimension. I mean, if we don't have good historical role models for our kids, for ourselves, to learn from, then we will be lost as a people. It's as pure and simple as that. And that's what these folks are trying to get us to remember.
Right. Speaking of labor, speaking of grassroots, I want to see if you could draw for our audience some connections or parallels, and, you know, sort of black and brown here, between the efforts and energy of Fannie Lou Hamer and that of, say, of a Chavez.
Oh, it's an excellent question. One is that there's one organizer I'm thinking of right now. Her name is Elizabeth Batita Martinez, and she actually she's a Chicana organizer who worked the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Mississippi, and took her experiences working with SNCC and COFO, and then went to California and worked in the Chicano struggle. Now, there are many parallels. I mean, we could talk all night about this. One of them is that issue of labor. African Americans and Latinos, I mean, there's a lot of important differences, but one of the parallels is the struggle against forced labor, the struggle against slavery. And this went well into the 20th century with debt peonage, convict labor. You had the same systems of exploitation that existed in Southern California and Arizona as you did in places like Florida and Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And so the struggle against peonage and convict labor was something that definitely you have a parallel between the two groups. You mentioned Cesar Chavez was building a very close relationship with Dr. King in the mid-60s. Before, of course, Dr. King was assassinated. But they both supported each other's efforts because they saw economic justice as being at the foundation of both the Latino civil rights movement and the Black civil rights movement. A. Philip Randolph said it best. He said, civil rights are meaningless unless you have economic justice. It's great to be able to vote.
That's a powerful statement. Repeat that one more time.
A. Philip Randolph said this at the March on Washington in 1963. I mean, he said, civil rights are useless unless you have economic justice, mm-hmm. unless you can earn bread to put on your family's table, unless you can pay your bills, unless you have things like collective bargaining, you really don't have anything. You're at the mercy, you're at the whim of the power structure. And that's why Randolph organized the March on Washington. You know, the subtitle of it was the March on Washington for what? Jobs. Freedom.
Exactly. You mentioned a little bit earlier that the piece that you'll be focusing on for the upcoming tour will be a Reconstruction. Wanted to see if you could draw any parallels between the Fugitive Slave Acts and what we see going on present day with Arizona and its immigration laws and the things that they're doing there.
It's really a kind of a scary comparison, but I think it's a really important one. You know, one is that you have these Fugitive Slave Acts in the 1840s, 1850s, and you also had states and territories that passed laws against African Americans coming to their territories. And so, for example, a lot of the Pacific Northwest was really staked out as a white homeland. If you were African American and you tried to, say, for example, settle an Oregon territory and you stayed there longer than a certain period of time, you would be subjected to being physically whipped. And so these were what you would call anti-immigrant measures in the 1850s aimed against African Americans primarily. Now we're talking about the contemporary period. There's always been an effort, Jamal, to control the flow of labor in this country and to keep workers as powerless as possible. And that's what these measures are really all about. I mean, they're not about getting rid of people because, the jobs are there. The labor is going to stay there. It's about keeping people terrorized. In the 1850s, when you had a Fugitive Slave Act, people could not even breathe. They had to stay hidden. They didn't have any rights. They were at the whim of the society. And the same thing now. It's really, there are some really shocking parallels. The same racists, the same type of racist people who are enforcing these laws in Arizona have a lot of affinity with the slave owners of the 1850s.
That is sad. That is so sad, but so true, unfortunately. I understand that you have a book that's out. Tell us a little bit more about your latest book.
Well, yeah, I have this book called Emancipation Betrayed. It focuses on the black freedom struggle in Florida. And it's really a book about, well, two things. You know, one, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the brutalities. I mean, the lynching, Florida had the highest per capita lynching rate in the country. And it was a very brutal place for African Americans. But at the same time, it's also a book about African-American organizing traditions in the state. And it starts with Reconstruction, you know, the tremendous hopes and aspirations that black Floridians had, the organizations they created, the labor, the political, the women's rights organizations. And it talks about the defeat of Reconstruction, but then it talks about how between the 1880s and the early 1920s, African Americans were building organizations, you might say a nation within a nation, to create organizing traditions, to create mutual aid societies, to create political groups that sometimes are literally underground. You know, they don't announce themselves, they don't have public, you know, they don't announce they're having meetings in the public because you have the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, people don't get up on podiums and speak. There is no charismatic leadership. When World War I ends and African-American veterans come back from France and come back from the military, black Floridians organize a statewide voter registration movement right after the end of World War I. And for 2 years, they organized up and down the entire state from Miami up to Jacksonville, across to Pensacola and urban and rural areas, and build a statewide voter registration movement, the first statewide civil rights movement in the country. And it becomes a model, if you will, for subsequent civil rights organization, because in the short term, the movement is defeated. because of the federal government, the Ku Klux Klan, you know, vigilantes. When people try, when African Americans try to vote in the election of 1920, they're shot, they're killed. There was a town in Ocoee, another black town or black settlement, which was wiped out. And so, again, it's a book both about the tragedies of American history, but also the efforts of African Americans to build democratic, small d democratic organization.
You stated that a big business, former planters' goal to make their workers powerless. Do you think that by giving workers citizenship, that would benefit America and more or less make them, give them a voice at least to stand up and say, hey, we are human?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because, see, the argument about citizenship goes like this. I mean, if you have a large group of workers who don't have citizenship, and this is the key to understanding Jim Crow, segregation was a labor system, like slavery was a labor system. It was designed to keep workers powerless. You kept African-American workers at the bottom. You kept them with second, third-class citizenship. They were not able to bargain for better wages and working conditions. And in doing so, it drugged the entire wage system, primarily in the South, down. This is what's happening to migrant workers today, wherever they're from, whether Mexico or Africa. They're kept in a Jim Crow state of non-citizenship. That is going to drag wages and working conditions for everyone down. You give those folks citizenship, you give them political rights, they're doing the work, and then all of a sudden you'll start to see wages and working conditions improve. You'll see this all across the board. And unfortunately, you don't have enough people in the political parties. I mean, this is such an obvious truth. If you keep 12 million people oppressed and subjugated and terrorized, then it's going to drive the entire economic system down. And this is really what happened during the Jim Crow South years. The South was the poorest part of the country because of the way it brutalized its working class. And unfortunately, the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, during Reconstruction, became the party of big business. This is why African Americans eventually turned away from the Republican Party, because the party signed on to this deal to keep African Americans disenfranchised, to keep workers powerless. And you see the same kind of that. That's why I mentioned earlier, the same kind of racism today directed against black and brown workers all throughout the South, but all throughout the country. It's just in the South, and i.e. Arizona or Florida, it's just a little more acute, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
A little more.
Well, public. What's your take on what's happening in Wisconsin right now?
Well, I think what's happening, you mentioned earlier, Tunisia, Egypt, Wisconsin, Spain. I mean, these are movements which really in Florida have given us a lot of hope. Mm-hmm. We're in a tough situation here with public employees, private employees, doesn't matter what kind of employees. I mean, what happened, I've been talking to folks who participated in Wisconsin. We have to be willing to go all the way. We have to be willing to do what Dr. King told us in a letter from Birmingham Jail. Every time, every chance I have the opportunity to give that book to someone, I give it, because what he says in that book is, look, if there's an injustice and it's chronic and the people in power don't want to negotiate, you've got to shut the system down. And that's the central message in Letter from Birmingham Jail. And that was the central message about what happened in Egypt. If you have an unjust autocratic system, you've got to shut the thing down. I mean, at a certain point, negotiation no longer is practical. And if you look at the great organizers in the civil rights movement, people like James Lawson, you mentioned Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, James Bevel and others, this is what they taught us. Is social movement organizing. It's more than just kind of a march and a rally. It's what folks did in Wisconsin. They went to the Capitol. They stayed there, by God, and they didn't leave. Now, the argument is that when they left, they began to lose power. But what they gave us, to me, was really an important model. It was kind of, in many ways, bringing Egypt to the United States or bringing Tunisia. And now, of course, we know folks in Spain and Greece and other places are organizing as well.
Mm-hmm. I thought, as you were speaking, came to my mind was that how people, particularly the younger generation, I'm sure you see this on the college campus, people sort of think, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur, I want to be a doctor, lawyer, but they don't think about doing the things like owning a landscape company or being a bricklayer or a tile layer or something of that nature. It's just, I don't know why, but that came to my mind as you were speaking.
Yeah. Well, you have to learn how to cooperate. I mean, this is the lesson of African-American history. It's a cooperative ethos. You know, it's collective struggle. It's great to be an individual and have aspirations, but unless you learn how to build a cooperative movement, you're going to be isolated. You're going to become alienated. You're going to despair. And so that's really, to me, one of the central lessons of African American history is how to organize.
Certainly, certainly. If you could speak briefly about entrepreneurship in the Black community versus entrepreneurship in the Latino community. And sort of cooperation and what have you.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, in the Jim Crow or we also call Juan Crow eras in those communities, you know, we often talked about, you know, economic empowerment, and we talked about building, you know, businesses. And there was, but I think the entrepreneurship also reaches beyond what Americans traditionally think of kind of the traditional business building, you know, to things like networking and to also things like, if you look at Los Angeles, I mean, one of the most, arguably the most powerful Latina businesswoman in the United States is Maria Elena Durazo, who is not a business person per se, but is secretary treasurer of the LA County Federation of Labor. And as such, is you could look at her as almost like a CEO of labor. And in the African-American community, you had the same corollary, where you had people like A. Philip Randolph. You had people like Milton Webster and others who, in a certain sense, were business people, but in another sense were also labor leaders. You think of education also. In Florida, we had Mary McCloy Bethune. We have institutions like Florida A&M, historically Black institutions. And so that's what I mean by extending the definition of entrepreneurship into areas like education, into areas like labor, because if you look at African-American and Latino history, we have been working-class people, you know, for the past five centuries. We probably will continue to be working-class people predominantly. And so what are the institutions that are going to lead to the greatest collective, you know, empowerment uplift? Arguably, it's education and labor. Or economic, you know, justice, if you will.
Certainly. Last question here for you. Give us the logistics of the tour, the dates and times and locations and hotel information, all the pertinent details of the tour.
Well, the most important detail is how to get in contact with Sherry Dupree. And,
okay.
And while folks are getting their pens out, I'll just briefly, again, this is co-sponsored by UNESCO, the United Nations, and it's going to go up and down Florida. There's going to be a visit to the Harry Moore Museum.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to
awesome.
Be Dan, Harry Moore is an amazing freedom fighter. There's going to be a day in Orlando. There's going to be a series of lectures, and that really begin on the 10th of July and go to July 15th. The emphasis is really on giving people, letting people visit African-American history sites, but also giving them materials, print materials, web materials, podcasts, documentary, you know, links to all these different educational things so that people can pass this on to their classes, to their communities, to their friends and loved ones. And Sherry Dupree's number, she can be reached if folks are interested in registering for this. Her number is area code 352-281-2286. Now, this tour will blow your mind because one of the places you're going to visit is St. Augustine, Florida. You're going to see the place, the slave market, where African Americans were bought and sold, and you're going to hear about the civil rights movement in 1964, which marched to the slave market in protest to argue for justice and freedom. You're going to learn about that story. It's just going to blow you away. I mean, It's such a remarkable tour. I wish we can do it all year round.
Certainly. Certainly. Last but not least, contact information for you. If folks wanted to maybe follow up with a email question or whatever contact information you were feel comfortable giving out, please do so.
Oh, yes. I would love for people, you know, to email me. I have a Gmail address, Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z, prof, P-R-O-F, at gmail.com. Or if you want to, you can Google the University of Florida Oral History Program. And the University of Florida Oral History Program has a lot of materials on African-American history, on some things that we've been talking about, Jamal, like, you know, Juneteenth, for example. We have a section on Juneteenth. But if you Google, I don't have the exact URL, but if you Google University of Florida Oral History Program, you'll go directly to some of these really rich resources.
Awesome, awesome. Professor Ortiz, any final comments that you would like to leave us with?
Well, I want to thank you for doing this show because, you know, people, my experience, and I'm sure you've had this because you're also an educator, is that in the United States, people often say, oh, let's not think about the past.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just think about the future. My experience, though, and the reason I became a historian was I observed that the more people try to run from the past, the more people try to escape from their history, the more it catches up to them. And
sure.
And really, it defines our lives. You know, what happened 20, 30, 40, 100, 200 years ago defines our lives. And we need to learn about it. And if you ignore it, man, it's really going to come back to bite you. So, I want to give you just a lot of love for doing this program. And thank you again for having me on your program. It's been a real pleasure and honor.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and also on behalf of our executive producer, Ms. Leslie Gist, again, we'd like to thank you. A lot of praise needs to go in her direction for connecting with you and getting you on the show to contribute your great knowledge. I can feel your passion in your words. I know that you're truly a man of what it is that you have put yourself into, you know, the study of history. I can tell that the passion of yours is something that you take seriously, and again, I appreciate you for that, and would like to encourage you to continue to do the great work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, and anytime you'd like to have me on your show as a guest or anything I can do to help, please let me know, okay?
Certainly. I appreciate you. Well, thank you once again. I would also like to thank those in the listening audience. It's been another great show. We have one more great show lined up for you this Thursday. At our normal time. I look forward to speaking with you all then. Have a good night.
Good night.